Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. On town meeting day, 35 school budgets were rejected by local voters. It's the largest number of defeats in more than a decade. Will lawmakers address the way that the state finances education in the second half of this year's session? House Speaker Shap Smith says it could take a few years to make any significant changes to Act 68.
We shouldn't do something just because there's urgency. We need to take the time to do it right. If we can get it right by the end of the session, well, that's great. But if it takes two sessions to get it done, then I'm willing to take that time to make sure that we get it right, not do something rash.
Are there some proposals that lawmakers should consider as both short-term and long-term solutions? That's one of the questions we have today for our guest, Governor Peter Shumlin. Governor, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to start off talking about education financing. If you've got a question on that subject, this is a great time to get that question in. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or just give us a call. Perhaps there are other issues on your mind. Great chance to talk to the governor, 1-800-639-2211. So, Governor, for the last month or so, you've encouraged Vermonters to closely scrutinize their school budgets, to evaluate their spending levels. As I mentioned on town meeting day, 35 towns rejected their budgets. So do you take that as a sign that voters heeded your advice?
You know, I don't want to take undue credit for anything that I say. You know, I think what I was really saying in my comments when asked about the upcoming school budget votes was that, you know, literally, you know, you'd have to be living in a cave somewhere if you didn't hear Vermonters' concern about the fact that property taxes are rising faster than their incomes, and it just keeps happening. And so they're frustrated. And, you know, I probably travel around the state as much as anyone, maybe more than most folks. And I just listened to people. And what I was hearing, Bob, was people saying, Gov, I don't get it. I don't get why, you know, my school budget's going up 8%, 9%, 7%, 6%. I know I can't afford it, and I'm really frustrated by it. So I think it has less to do with anything I say and more to do with what Vermonters say. You know, my takeaway from town meeting is local control is alive and well. Vermonters understand that showing up at town meeting makes a big difference. And they came out, and in several communities, as you know, they said, listen, we just got to find a way to make this work for us, and this isn't.
So we got this email from Kathy, who's a school board member in Burlington, and she wonders if you think that the 35 budgets that went down are a message that the state really can't use property taxes. Is it a message that using property taxes to fund education may not be a good idea in the future?
Well, Kathy's right about that. I mean, let's be honest about this. The fact that in a democracy, in our most important obligation in a democratic society, which is making sure that everyone, regardless of income, has access to the best education we can get them, which, of course, is the public school system, that we choose to fund that nationally in all 50 states through a property tax, you know, the most regressive tax that you can think of, really, is a little bit nutty. But having said that, what Vermont has done with Act 60 and 68 is try to turn the regressive property tax into an income tax, and we do a better job of that, believe it or not, than any other state in America. So, you know, this is a very complex issue, but let's really try to boil it down to what's going on. I mean, you just mentioned that there were, you know, 35 communities, many of them large, that voted down their school budgets. Now, that's a big deal. What maybe folks don't know is that 33 of those 35 towns, when you look at their per pupil spending, how much they spend for every kid in the classroom, they were asking voters to approve an 8.5% increase in 33 of those 35 towns. And Vermonters will tell you their incomes aren't going up 8.5% a year. So you have to ask the question, well, why is that? And in many of those communities, their school budgets didn't go up 8.5%. Their per pupil spending did. And that's really what we're talking about. So our challenge is that in the last, you know, decade or more, we've watched the number of kids that we're educating drop over 20,000 students, and it's going to continue to drop going forward. So we've designed a system to serve a lot more kids than we've got showing up. So the question for all of us, and you know, I'm not a big believer in pointing fingers. We're all in this together. School boards, local communities, select boards, smart people in communities that have ideas on how we can do it better, the legislature, the governor. This has got to be a team sport. The question is, how do we right-size the ship so that we still have the best education system in the country, because Vermonters really care about education, thankfully, and therefore we have the best education system in the country. How do we right-size the ship while maintaining that quality and reducing spending? And really the big culprit is, in too many communities, we now have too many kids sitting in the classroom getting instruction. There just aren't enough of them. And we've really got to look at how we can move that ball.
So some people might wonder if this is sort of the fatal flaw of Act 68 these days. Let's take a community that had a level-funded budget this year, no increase whatsoever, but they lost some students. So now their per-pupil spending is going to go up, just like you said. It goes up. It drives up the statewide property tax rate. So the community that had zero increase in spending might now be facing a 4, 5, 6% increase in spending. Does that make sense?
Well, it does if you only look at their overall budget. What you really have to look at is the number of kids that they're asking to educate this year versus the number of kids they asked to educate last year. That's really the problem. Now, let's take an example. Hardwick. Hardwick saw a 2.67% reduction in their budget. Down 2.67%. But per pupil spending, if you look at the number of kids they're educating in Hardwick this year, it's up. They're asking for 7.5% more money per pupil than they were a year ago. Take Underhill, where we've heard, read a lot about Underhill. They saw a slight decrease in spending, 0.03%, so basically a level-funded budget. But guess what? The per pupil spending, they're asking for 9.5% more on per kid. So listen, all these communities are trying hard, but the challenge we have is, really, when you want to look at big picture, there's a lot of things driving this. As we know, grand lists are going down, value of property is going down, so that's driving up rates. You need to raise more money, higher tax rate, when you have property values that are suddenly lower. First time since Act 60 and 68 that that's happened. We know there are other factors driving it, but the big one is this issue, that we have fewer and fewer kids. That we have never right-sized the ship. It's hard to do because you can't just say to Hardwick, hey, you know, you don't have enough kids in your classroom. Can you ship some more in? You know, where do you bring them from? So we've really got to have a conversation about governance, structure, class size, and really look at the facts about how we can start to right-size our educational ship to the number of kids that we're educating. If this is a temporary thing and projections said, hey, you know, in 4 years, we're going to have more kindergartners and first graders than we know what to do with again, we wouldn't be having to have this conversation. But that's not the case.
So do you think there's anything that the legislature could or should do in the next 2 months to deal with this situation, or is it a longer-term problem?
Well, let's talk short-term and long-term. Listen, we don't want the property tax rate to go up 7 cents, despite all the local decisions that were made on spending. So I can guarantee you that I'm going to work together with the legislature. We're going to try to come up with creative ways short term to try and avoid a 7 cent increase. I can guarantee you there's going to be uniformity on that, Republicans and Democrats working together. No one wants to go home with a 7 cent property tax increase. So we'll try to do some things, some magic, to get it down a bit.
Well, explain now, the magic to us. I mean, you need more money to go into the education fund, don't you?
You do need to temporarily put some more money in on a one-time basis, as you know. It doesn't solve the problem. It makes folks feel a little better this year, okay?
But where does that money come from?
Well, we're pretty good at finding it. But I can guarantee you that we're not going to leave here. I would think it's highly unlikely that we leave here with a 7 cent property tax increase. Let's just leave it at that. I think you'll find legislative leadership, rank-and-file legislators working together with me to try to find something less than 7 cents. Having said that, that doesn't solve the problem. Listen, we can't solve this problem by taking money out of one pocket and pulling it out of the other pocket instead of the one we're spending it from. The problem is that we're spending too much for the number of kids that we have. You know, per pupil spending, had budgets passed, would have been over $14,000 a kid. So to right the ship, let's talk long term. What do we do? First, I would say we should look at every single proposal that's out there where folks think they have a better idea than Act 68 and really get into the weeds on it. How would it work? Second, We're already having a conversation. These started long before the school votes. I've been meeting with legislative leadership, with chairs of committees of jurisdiction since day one of the legislature, working quietly to ask the question, are there governance changes that we could make that would help local communities send out as good a product or even a better product for kids, better education system for less money? Governance changes we could be encouraging. So we're looking at that, as you know. And third and finally, let's be sure that we're looking at the question of, you know, how do we come up with a guideline for communities on class size that might help drive the debate that we're losing?
So just to be clear, 1 cent on the statewide property tax rate is about $10 million. So what you're saying is through some magic, you're going to come up with $15 or $20 million to help keep that rate lower than 7 cents.
Well, that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it, of course, is changing the disparity between residential and non-residential rates. So you can always pick up some relief for taxpayers that way, too. So all I can tell you is we're going to look at all the options.
Let's talk to Chris, who's calling from Bennington. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hello there. Thank you. Hello, Governor. I'm hoping that as this conversation unfolds, we can pay some more attention to some of the communities that don't necessarily match the profile of what you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Down in Bennington, for instance, the number of pupils we have entering school is actually on the increase, which is different than the majority of the state. Our per-pupil spending is also less, about $2,000 less than the anticipated per-pupil spending average across the state. For the Bennington School District budget this year, we were looking for a 13 cent per 100,000 increase. About 11.5 of those cents came from mandates from Montpelier. So really, it was just over a cent and a half that the local schools were asking for in terms of an increase.
Yeah, Chris, Let me just cut you off there. I don't want to cut you off, but I'd love to know what your facts are there. I'd be surprised if recent new local mandates brought you 11.5% increase in Bennington. I just can't believe that's true. What are they?
An 11% increase, but an 11 cent increase per the $100,000. This was the increase we were looking at. These are figures that were given to us by our supervisory union at both town meeting and at school board meetings.
Well, I'd love to have my folks sit down with your folks and look at those numbers, because we are very careful about passing mandates from the state that are unfunded down to local communities. I can tell you, I'm a big believer in local control. I started on a select board. I'm very, very careful about, as a legislator, about passing unfunded mandates, and as a governor, I'm very, very careful about signing them. So I'd love to know how your superintendent got those numbers.
Chris, do you know any of those specific mandates?
I don't offhand, and I'm sorry. I'm just in the car and not at home.
Okay.
Well, Chris, let's sit down. You get call my office, 828-3333. I want to run through those numbers. I don't believe it to be true.
Governor, we got this email about income sensitivity, and about 60% of Vermont property owners qualify for income sensitivity. That allows them to pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of their property. And the person writing this email wanted to know, does that indicate that there's something wrong with the funding formula, that a majority of property owners can't afford to pay their taxes straight up? Income sensitivity isn't a support for education. It's a support for home ownership at the expense of education funding. I'm wondering, do you think some changes need to be made to income sensitivity? Is it too generous?
You know, there are those who believe that's the case. And my point is, listen, anyone who has an idea about ways that we can improve quality and contain cost, we're open to it. And the legislature's open on a bipartisan basis. Now, there are some who feel that income sensitivity allows folks to go to local communities, vote a school budget increase that's, you know, higher than the rate of their incomes, and then not feel the effects of it because they're income sensitized. All I could suggest is that when you start defeating as many school budgets as were just defeated in the last town meetings, that sort of speaks against that theory. You've got people who are income sensitized showing up in the biggest cities in Vermont and saying, wait a minute, this is too much for us. So, you know, let's make sure that we're reacting to real facts and not things that we frankly just don't know.
On a different subject, we got an email from Vincent in Stratford, Connecticut, who wanted to know if you'd like to see the Vermont legislature increase the state minimum wage. I know this week you met with the President of the United States and the governors of New England on this subject. Vincent wants to know, will Vermont go first? And if the other states don't, will you continue to support that? And how much of an increase in the minimum wage do you think would be a good idea?
The answer, Vincent, is yes. Vermont will go forward regardless of what the states do around us. I really feel that this is a critical piece of quality of life and fairness in Vermont. And let's just look at the minimum wage question in this state, forgetting the others for a minute. I don't think there's a Vermonter who thinks it's fair that if you work hard, you get a job, you work 40 hours or 50 hours a week, they should be going home with $14,000 in your pocket, which if you work 40 hours a week is the current result. So what that means is most of those folks, you know, need some kind of other assistance to support their families. So we're saying we want you to get a job. We want folks to get into the workforce. In some cases, we're saying we want you off the welfare system. But when you go out and get a job, you're still going to have to depend on the system to feed your family. It doesn't make sense. So I feel very strongly that, you know, while we're seeing an economic recovery in Vermont, and we are, and, you know, we've added 11,000 jobs since I've been governor. We've got the lowest unemployment rate this side of the Mississippi. Vermonters are actually starting to see, finally, their incomes go up on average. But the challenge we have is that too many folks have been left behind. The middle class continues to get kicked in the teeth, and lower wage earners keep getting kicked in the teeth. So this is what I'd like to see us do. I'm going to propose to the legislature that we increase Vermont's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2017, one-third, one-third, one-third until we get there in 17, that we suspend our index for that period, and after that period, the index goes back into effect. I think 10-10, as the president has said, makes sense. Now, sometimes you hear folks against the minimum wage say, you know, it'll make us uncompetitive with our neighbors. So when I was down at the National Governors Association, I started a conversation with our neighboring governors, Governor Malloy of Connecticut, Governor Patrick in Massachusetts, doing a great job down there, Governor Chafee down in Rhode Island, Governor Hassan wants to move something in New Hampshire. And we said as a region, why don't we all agree we're going to get to 10-10 by this date. So that's our goal. I think we can do it. But if the other states fail, Vermont should bowl ahead. This is really important.
What do you say to those members of the business community who say raising the minimum wage is going to result in fewer jobs?
I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong. I actually think it will raise our ability to grow businesses, grow jobs, not reduce it. Now, if we were saying, listen, we're going to take you from $8 to $8.25, we're going to take you to $20 next year, that would be a big problem. But what we're really saying is we want to beat our index by getting to 10-10 by 2017. So we're giving businesses time over 3 years to get there. So it's a very reasonable approach. But we are saying, you know, no one should work hard and not be able to feed their family. It's not fair for folks to join in the American dream and the Vermont dream and then be told, we can't pay you a wage where you can feed your kids, where you can put sneakers on the kids, where you can pay your heating bill. Just not right.
Today in the program, our guest is Governor Peter Shumlin. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment for the governor, this is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Governor Peter Shumlin. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Heather in Barrie. Hi, Heather. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I worked for nearly 20 years in the retail industry and did not make nearly enough to pay my bills. I ended up having to put my groceries on credit cards and had tremendous student loan debt. And apologies, I'm sorry. My throat's a little scratchy from recovering from a cold. And ended up having to file for bankruptcy because I couldn't raise my son. And, you know, it's an impossible situation. I agree to have people working for less than a livable wage. Another big part of the problem when I was a young worker was being able to take time off when I was sick. I worked many jobs, both in small businesses and in large businesses that didn't provide this basic right. And my question for the governor is, you know, in my opinion, and I think most people in Vermont agree that we need to move forward with establishing paid sick days for all workers, and that, you know, it's long over, raising the minimum wage and getting it closer to a livable wage is long overdue. I know you haven't yet decided if you're going to push for both, but I hope you'll see that these two issues are very much linked together, and that this is an opportunity to move forward.
Okay, Heather, thanks. The governor actually just said, Heather, that he is going to be supporting an increase in the minimum wage to $10.10 over a three-year period. So he did address that part of your question. What about paid sick leave? Are you going to support that bill? Do you want that bill to pass this year?
Heather, first of all, thanks for calling. It takes courage to call in and tell your story. And you are the reason why this is so important. I mean, let me just say a word about the minimum wage, because the story you just told is the story of Vermont and, frankly, the story of America. Folks think that raising the minimum wage is going to mean that we're going to pay entry-level teenagers more money. And, you know, some folks say they don't need it. The statistics don't back that up. Statistics back up that it's going to help folks like you who are trying to support a son, are working hard. You're not 16 years old. And you can't make ends meet. And in fact, the interesting thing about minimum wage increase is, and this is, you know, dispel the myths out there, over half of minimum wage workers in this country are 55 years or older. Way over half are women, because we know there's a wage gap for women in Vermont and in America. So the minimum wage, I believe, can get done this legislative session. Now, I also agree with you on paid family leave. I don't think that there's a Vermonter who thinks that it's fair or wise, particularly for lower wage workers, to be in jobs where they're told, if you're sick, you got to come to work or you can't pay your bills. The challenge there is it's not as simple to solve, as you know. We really haven't figured out how we're going to pay for paid family leave. So I'm less optimistic that that'll get to my desk this session, but it's a conversation I want to continue to have. I'm going to insist that we get the minimum wage bill to my desk. I think that's a step we've got to make.
So tell us about the problems with paid sick leave. What do you see as the obstacles or the complexity that needs to be dealt with?
The fight there, or the challenge there, is in the companies who aren't doing this. And frankly, most companies do, as you know, in Vermont. But in the companies that don't, how do you pay for it? And obviously, you know, there's a wide disparity of views there. But I think that we really haven't vetted that adequately.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mary in Cornwall. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I would love to have a whole day to ask Mr. Shumlin some questions, but I'll just take a few moments here. My concerns are over this fracked gas pipeline. Mm-hmm. That is proposed to be coming down our state and across our land here in Cornwall and many of our friends' land to serve international paper. And it seems like Vermont used to be known for its fountains, maple trees, farms. Now we're known for heroin and a pipeline. And we've made national news in the New York Times, the Huffington Post. I don't know that... that's good for our state's image. I know it's not good for our state's citizens. And Mr. Shumlin, you had said yourself that solar jobs tripled, that we have more solar jobs than any state in the country. Those are your words.
Yep.
And I'm afraid that this pipeline, I'm sure that this pipeline is going to stop that move toward renewable energy, and people will take the path of least resistance, which is just plugging into this pipe. What do you say to the towns, Shoreham, Moncton, Cornwall, to the Addison County Regional Planning Committee, to all the people who voted no on town meeting day? I voted against this pipeline. What do you have to say to them?
All right, Mary, thanks very much. And let's add a second question to Mary's, because we got
quite a few questions in there.
Well, we also have an email from Joe who says, we don't allow fracking in Vermont, so isn't it hypocritical to pipe fracked gas all over the state? So what about both of those?
Well, Mary, thanks for the call, and Joe, too, for the email. And you got a lot in that question. I want to start with where you didn't end, with a heroin suggestion. listen, my job when I got elected is to solve problems. And some of them are easy to talk about, and some of them aren't quite so happy to talk about. But I firmly believe that by putting in place, first of all, having a conversation about something no one wants to talk about, including politicians, the fact that we're losing too many Vermonters to a disease that we were treating earlier as simply a crime, that this conversation is going to allow us to save lives, to reduce the number of opiate addictions that we have in Vermont, and to come out with a happier story. And I still believe that the nation sees Vermont as the best quality of life in the country, best farms. You talked about the solar farms, the solar jobs we've added since I've been governor. Listen, we've added 2,200 new food jobs. We got 5% more farmers than we had when I came on the job. This isn't happening by coincidence. So I'm not worried about our quality of life or our image being shattered by the fact that we talk the truth about challenges we have in the state. Second, on the fracking and the gas, listen, what I say to local communities that have voted against it is I'm a big believer in local control. I think it's fantastic that we have a system where everyone can be heard and reasonable people can disagree on this one. But I'm not in any way suggesting that the communities that voted against this pipeline should have different feelings. I support local control and I support the debate. I do think that in our challenge to get off of oil and to move to other ways of powering the future so that we're not destroying our planet, I'm one of the governors who believes that's the most important thing that we can get done fast, and we're not getting there fast enough, that on the path to that new energy future, which Vermont is leading the way on, we could disagree on how to get there. And my own view is that natural gas is a transition from oil that will allow us, while we figure out, because we can't flip the switch on oil, unfortunately, that since we can't in this transition, it will allow us to send a lot fewer carbons into bad stuff into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases, because natural gas is the cleanest of the oils to burn. So we're going to have Vermonters replacing dirty oil in their homes with cleaner gas. And I think that's smart. Now, you can disagree with me. We can disagree. I understand the argument against it. But when we say frack gas running through your community, yes, some of it will be from fracking. Some of it will be from the other ways we extract natural gas. But, you know, if you carry that argument to the next level, the gas that you put in your car right now often comes from fracking. So do we stop driving our cars? I mean, the point is we got to be reasonable here. My view is that that natural gas pipeline is going to move Vermonters from dirty oil to a much cleaner emitter in this transition that we're making. It's going to save them a ton of loot. It's going to grow jobs and economic opportunities. And reasonable people can disagree on how we get there, and I think we do.
Getting back to Joe's email, though, if we don't allow fracking in Vermont, but we accept it and allow it in other states and take the advantage of the benefits of that from other states, isn't that somewhat hypocritical?
You know, sure it is. And there's some hypocrisy in everything that we do. But I think we, in our efforts to try get the attention of the nation that we got to move to cleaner fuels, they sent me a bill on fracking that I was happy to sign. The fact of the matter is, none of this is simple. As Mary just pointed out, you can easily make the argument that we shouldn't be, you know, building gas pipelines because it's still a carbon oil-based product. So, you know, purity is a beautiful thing. If only we could always have it.
Let's turn to James in Leicester. Hi, James. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. The governor is correct when he says that the state has spent a ton of loot to clean up Lake Champlain, and he's also correct when he says that we've gotten nothing for it. He indicated in an article in the Vermont Digger this morning that he did not want to raise any taxes to pay for cleaning up the lake, and once again, I think he's correct, because we can't throw good money after bad. We've already shown that that isn't the way to do it. Mr. Mears and Mr. Ross have submitted a plan called a Plan for a Clean Lake Champlain, which seems to reassert the policies of the past, the nutrient management plans and the accepted agricultural practices rules. We're just going to sort of double down on those, even though they haven't worked. So I'm sort of curious to know if the governor has something else in his mind that is going to fix this problem, because the EPA, as he knows, wants the problem solved now. Time's up.
Yeah, and as you know, James, the EPA's solution is even is the worst of them all because because they couldn't get a new Clean Water Act and rules through this Congress in the last God knows how long, the only authority they really have is to change the requirements on our wastewater treatment plants. And as you know, they're a teeny, teeny fraction of the pollutants being put into the water. So, you know, they've got bigger challenges than we do. But listen, let's just back up. This is what I'm doing, James, in relation to this one. We all want to clean up the lake. We want to clean up our waterways. We have wasted millions, tens and tens, millions of dollars, getting nothing back, in my view, or not enough back, in the years prior to my at least having the responsibility for Vermont's money. So what I'm saying is, and I say it to Commissioners, Mears, to Secretary Ross, to anyone who will listen, you all are doing great work, but you've got to show me a plan that's going to work before I'm going to support any money to pay for it, whether it's federal money or state money, because we have just wasted opportunity after opportunity, and I want to actually solve the problem. Having said that, I recognize that even if we got everything right this year, it wouldn't clean up the water for some time because the phosphorus is in there. The challenge is already in the lake and in the other waterways, and so it's going to take a long time no matter what. But I don't want to spend any more money until we figure out how we actually get scientific results that we can believe in.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dennis in Jeffersonville. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, and hi, Governor. You may remember me from in front of the library in Jeffersonville when we talked about DSL.
I do. Thanks for calling. Yeah, we were up there announcing a breakthrough, as I recall.
Yeah, and I want to report that we've done tremendous work here, and we're pretty much 100%.
That's fantastic. Listen, I'm going to take you around with me. Come on, we got to go on the road.
All right.
Well, congratulations.
I own about 100 acres, and I've got about 40 in sugar bush and most of it in current use, and I rely on income sensitivity. I feel that I'm providing, with my land, a service to Vermont, to Vermonters and to tourists. And I feel that I need that. Without that help from the state, I could not maintain 100 acres of land here.
I get it, Dennis, and keep it up, by the way. You're what's keeping Vermont, and a lot of other folks, too. Listen, there's an effort in the legislature right now, as you probably know, to mess with current use, to make some changes. My feeling is, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And current use is working. It's working for folks like you and a lot of farmers and forest owners across the state. And I think we got a lot to be proud of there.
Today on the program, our guest is Governor Peter Shumlin. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With us today, Governor Peter Shumlin, and our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Governor, you've said that the administration, probably sometime in the next month or so, will present lawmakers with a menu of options to finance a single-payer system. Sort of conceptually, as you look at this issue, do you think people should be paying for health care after 2017 when you hope to put this system in place? Do you think for the most part people should be paying based on their ability to pay?
Yes.
So are we looking at So would either the income tax or a payroll tax be a key part of that, so to achieve that goal?
Listen, this is what I know. I've learned a little bit about health care over the last few months, as you know. And what we're talking about here, sometimes we talk about this one as if we can flick a switch and, you know, we're going to turn on a single-payer universal health care system. We have to remember that we're talking about a complex problem, not just how to pay for it, how to change the way we pay for it now, but most importantly, how we ensure that we pay less with better quality outcomes for our healthcare system. And what I've learned is that whether it's how to pay for it or how to change the delivery system, it's a ton of work. We got a ton of research going on about particularly how to pay for it. It's complicated. And we're not going to present any options until we think we actually have some that make sense. So having said that, listen, this is what we're trying to do. I want to put it in plain English because I keep reading these press reports that say, you know, the governor is trying to raise $2.1 billion, or whatever the number is that was chosen for that day, to pay for health care by 2017. I'm saying, wait a minute. No, actually not true. We're paying for health care right now, and we're paying a lot of money for it. What we're trying to do is to make sure that we're paying less than we otherwise would have for better outcomes. How do we do that? We got the Green Mountain Healthcare Board working together with our hospitals and our docs to design a delivery system, to really redesign our delivery system so that we reimburse providers based on quality instead of quantity. Just think about that. Right now we use fee-for-service. Quantity of care is what they get reimbursed for. Move it to quantity, that quality. That means, you know, giving an incentive from your providers for getting you off the smokes, helping you get out running, eating good Vermont ag-grown food instead of that corporate food from the rest of America, doing all the things that we know that we should be doing, getting off the smokes and the rest. The second piece is, as they're doing that, we're trying to figure out a fair way to pay for health care. Now, what's wrong with the system now? The system now, and I'll try not to give you a state-of-the-state address on this and keep it short, but the system now is incredibly unfair. Let's take me as an example. As the one of the highest paid state employees in Vermont, I pay the same amount for health care as the good, hardworking person who comes in and cleans my office at the end of the day. Now, our wages are very different. The other problem with the way we're paying for health care now is some people pay, some people choose not to or can't, and those that choose not to get paid for by those who pay. I mean, so we've got two broken systems here. One is the delivery system that will eat us alive, bankrupt us, if we don't find better ways to deliver health care for less money. So we're on that. And the other is the way we pay for it is unfair. It doesn't include everybody. It asks some folks to pay who are good enough to do it if they choose, and they do it, but those who choose not to get paid for by those who do. We can do a lot better on both fronts.
So let me make sure I heard what you said correctly. You said you don't want to present a menu of options until you really understand how it's all going to work. So are you saying that the administration is not going to present this menu of options to lawmakers before the end of the session?
I don't see the end of the session as being very critical, to be honest. They only got 6 or 7 weeks left. They're going to be focusing not so much on health care, as you know, but on lots of other issues, including property taxes. Listen, let's be honest about this. This lift, it's going to be one of the most difficult lifts in political history in Vermont, is going to be done by the next legislature. So I'm saying to my team, don't spend a lot of time getting committees that won't even be the same committees working on something that isn't going to be voted on anyway, and that we don't have the answers for yet. Let's focus on what we can get done in this session. So it's not a top priority for me. I would rather have them looking at what's wrong with the system now, who's paying what, and understanding what's broken.
But don't you need time for lawmakers to consider this? And if you put this off until 2015, won't that affect the timetable for implementing single payer in 2017? It's all going to be just scrunched together?
I don't think 2 years is a scrunch. Listen, I want to get this done, as you know, as quickly as possible, and federal law precludes us from doing it before January 1st of 2017. As I just mentioned, it's not flicking a switch. It's complicated. As soon as we have options that make sense, we'll share them with anyone that wants to see them. I can tell you we're not there yet.
So what do you say to those folks who hear you say that and say what you've really made is a very political calculation, that you don't want lawmakers and yourself going into the November election with a piece of paper that says, here are 30 different ways that you can raise $2 billion, that you don't want to have to deal with that issue, so postponing it until 2015 is the safest political thing to do?
You know, my job as governor is to work really hard to get tough things done that will help grow jobs, economic opportunity, and improve the lives of Vermonters. That's what I focus on. I don't sit around thinking, you know, if I do this on property taxes, what's the political effect going to be? Or if we actually get health care right in Vermont, you know, what's the political effect going to be? This is a huge one, Bob. If we keep doing what we're doing on health care, and think about this for a minute. Right now, Vermonters spend 20 cents of every dollar they make on health care. If health care costs grew at the same rate for the next 10 years as they did for the last 10, that number would double. I say to Vermonters, you know, raise your hand if spending 40 cents on a dollar in a decade on health care in Vermont is a prescription for prosperity, job growth, or a bright economic future for you and your family. And we all know it's not. So what I'm saying is, one thing we've learned about the Affordable Care Act, get it right.
So when you said
getting it right is more important than a few seconds on the clock.
When you said it's not as simple as just flipping a switch.
Right.
Does that mean that, you know, it's not necessarily going to be January 1st, 2017? It could be later in the year. Who knows? It could be sometime during 2018 that Vermont would implement a single-payer system.
You know, I've become very weary of dates. My goal is to get us there by January 1st, 2017. That's my goal. I will not fall off the turnip truck if I miss that by a week or a month or more. I want to get it done. We've got to get this done. But this is really hard stuff, important stuff, and what's more important to me about than hitting a particular date, although I really want to hit that date, is getting this right. Because what I've said many times is, listen, if we can't deliver a healthcare system where we spend less money than we otherwise would have, having everybody in, healthcare just because you're a Vermonter, not who you live, where you live, how rich you are, how poor you are, if we can't get the money part of it right, we will not push send on this system. But then we're in real trouble because we've got the system we've got that most hospital and docs will tell you isn't sustainable. And we're not talking about the corny grocery store here. We're not talking about the dry cleaner going out of business. We're talking about our healthcare system. So I really want to get this one right. I know I got to get it right. Huge responsibility as a governor to be the first in the country to get this one right. I want January 1st, 2017. I wish the feds hadn't given us that obstacle to that date. But I'll take it as soon as I can get it.
Let's turn to Teresa in Fairfax. Hi, Teresa. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question about Vermont Health Connect. My family, my husband and my children are premium, and we paid it back in January. As of today, our coverage is still pending. And when I asked Vermont Health Connect why, they said the state premium assistant has not come through. So I called the governor's office, left my information, did not get a response back. And so I guess I'm wondering, where exactly is that coming from? Why am I still waiting? And how come when they could give me the information for my tax credit and give me that information, that wasn't something that was maybe paid forward or paid up front?
What's your number?
My number?
Yeah, I'm going to get someone to call you and fix it.
Or maybe what we could do is maybe we could have Teresa give us one of our producers her number, and then
you
can,
I'm going to have
you
give us your number. We're going to figure out what to get to the bottom of this. It doesn't make any sense, so we'll get on it. But I'm going to have the producer give you your number, and I'll have someone call you. It's Friday, but I'll make sure that someone gets to you on Monday, okay?
Thank you, yes.
We'll get it figured out.
We've got about 2 minutes left in the program, but we did get this email from Mark, who feels that you hit the nail on the head during your State of the State address when you encourage state officials to respond to drug and alcohol addiction as a chronic disease. There is a bill moving through the legislature. I think it's going to be considered in the Senate next week, S-295, that sets up the whole procedure of setting up treatment and trying to keep some people out of jail. Is it moving the way you want to?
Absolutely. Legislature's doing great work on this. They get it. We've got bipartisan support. And, you know, this is the one thing that I think really could sacrifice our quality of life in Vermont is the growing battle that we're losing against opiates. And when I talk to other governors, Republicans and Democrats, they're all losing it too. So this is not just a Vermont problem. Most conservative Republican Tea Party governors in the country were with me in at the NGA in Washington saying, we got to get this one right. We're with you all the way. I think we're getting more governors to talk about it, and we've got a national problem we got to solve.
And another email asks, do you think the state has enough clinical resources to deal with this opiate addiction problem that you're trying to address?
I do. And if we don't, we'll get the resources. From a taxpayer standpoint, you know, it costs $54,000 a year to put someone in jail, or $1,123 a week. We can do great opiate treatment, wraparound services, mental health for $123 a week. I mean, just dollars and cents. I know it's tough, but it's cheap to get folks from addiction to recovery. It's expensive to knock them in jail.
So do you anticipate you could take some of that money from the corrections budget and put it into these resources?
You know, I'm leery of that because we haven't gotten to the point where we can say we're actually seeing those numbers reversed. But logic would suggest that in the long run, if we get this right, we should see our correction spending reduced.
That's going to do it for our program today. Many thanks to Governor Peter Shumlin for being with us. Governor, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Monday on the program, Nina Keck's guest will be Human Services Secretary Doug Racine. We'll look at how the state investigates child abuse claims and what his agency is doing in wake of a toddler's death allegedly from abuse. That's Monday on Vermont Edition. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Eric Ewazin and the new Trombone Collective provided our town meeting music theme this week. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.